Available now from fxphd.com, all new speed grade fast forward training. Download immediately all 10 classes and footage covering CS6 speed grade. Check it out at fxphd.com. Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, and this week we are going to the Bourne Legacy. Yes, a Bourne film without Bourne. And to talk to us about it is Matt Wallen. Matt, how are you?
I'm great.
And Mark Christensen, how are you, sir?
I'm well enough. I'm nursing a head cold and not on my regular mic, so I apologize to your listeners. I'm going to let you guys do most of the talking.
Okay, well, this is an interesting franchise, and certainly I was very agin it when I heard about the fact that it was going to be without the star of the previous three films, without the director of the previous three films. It seemed an odd thing to have a Jason Bourne film without Jason Bourne. I guess coming at the film from my point of view, I even started to question whether this needed to be a Bourne film at all. It seemed to be like a film that was sort of not necessarily related to Bourne. It just had Bourne kind of stuck in it to justify the nameplate at the front. But, Matt, what did you think?
I see where you're coming from. I guess I'm a fan of the franchise overall, and I was a little, you know, disheartened, I suppose, like most fans of the series, to find that both the director and the main star wouldn't be returning in this episode. But I have to say, I was really surprised by this movie. I actually enjoyed it a lot. It reminded me a lot of, I think, like the other Bourne films too, but this one even more so. It was very much like, you know, if Alan J. Pakula and William Friedkin got together in the 70s and had a baby, and that baby made a movie. It had that kind of 1970s conspiracy kind of vibe going on, with just, you know, a ton of, I thought, pretty good action. And it even kind of felt sort of like that idea of, I know people have sometimes talked about wanting to see a Felix Leiter movie. You know, he's the CIA guy in all the James Bond films, and it really had that kind of flavor too. So I was really pleasantly surprised, and I felt like it actually fit in well for me with the rest of the franchise. It didn't bother me that in the end we didn't have the same you know, sort of top billing. I still thought it worked well with Jeremy Renner and Rachel Weisz.
I thought Jeremy Renner was really good. In fact, I think that I liked the film most because of him, and I thought his performance was really good. And quite frankly, I liked the story. I just don't know. It just felt to me as if somebody said, well, we need to somehow get this in related to the Bourne thing, so we'll just keep on putting bits of Bourne stuff in at the side, which you could easily re-edit that and just change some of the dialogue and have it as just a completely another film.
Yeah, I think maybe, though, you know, it's one of those things too where maybe even to get the go-ahead and the green light, you know, they had something that they were going to do previously, and then, you know, things didn't come together and they sort of went ahead with this film. And maybe part of the marketing strategy behind the film, I would guess, was, you know, to play off the success of the Bourne films and to try to incorporate it into that same universe. And you know, it functions, I think, well enough in that capacity. But I think you're right. I mean, I think it could have been a standalone film on its own.
I mean, Matt, didn't it just seem odd to you at some point when they jumped to the shooting in the train station of the journalist? It was like, oh, okay. And then that didn't go anywhere, really, because there was nowhere they could go because they couldn't show Jason Bourne. So then it just all subsides again and we move on. And it was almost like, really? It just felt like a left turn in the film. It was almost like a contractual obligation.
I guess I didn't see it that way. I felt like that was sort of the beginning of the process of elimination that they were sort of going through, the sort of wiping the slate clean. They started with the reporter, and then they went through and they were trying to, you know, eliminate all the other operatives who were part of the program. They gave them this, you know, triangular yellow pill as opposed to the blue and the green pills or whatever, which I guess, you know, wound up having the effect of essentially killing them, right, in some fashion. And it seemed like that was sort of the start of this long sequence of this kind of mop-up operation, which culminates in the sequence in the laboratory, and then sort of is the reason for the remaining action in the movie.
But Mark Christensen, would you have preferred to have edited out bits of Jason Bourne, the earlier first three films, and seen a bit more? Like, I would have loved to have seen that, what looked like a Chinese or Asian operative, the one that takes the yellow pill. I'd have loved to have had some story on her, cared about her, and then had her killed, so I was kind of emotionally really angry at the protagonists. But instead of that, it was like, oh, we don't have time for that story because we have to keep on flashing back to sequences of people stepping out of sit rooms to phone somebody just to remind us that this is a Bourne franchise. What do you think, Mark?
Yeah, there were a number of loose ends that X-Files and Lost style were brought up in the film and really never followed through. Fundamentally, it's the story of a drug dealer and a drug addict, his dealer. They're trying to get to the big score before the law catches up with them. I mean, I'm being a little facetious, but I don't think that the whole thing felt so cynical as I expected. In that, going in, I really did feel like, you know, they do have a great franchise. Bourne has really taken the place of Bond in many ways, and in fact, the Bond film started copying the Bourne films recently. And it's notable that this film featured a pretty spectacular parkour sequence, so they're trading back and forth on that. But to me, the film started out too clever by half, where you really needed to remember a lot of details about a film that's, well, the most recent of which is 5 years ago, to kind of get an idea really what was going on beyond that there's this protagonist and, you know, we sympathize with him because he's repeatedly attempting to be killed. But beyond that, we don't have a ton of rooting interest in anything that's going on. It's something that always bugs me about sequel movies, you know, that presume their audience is coming along for the ride. And that's okay. But then to top it off, it felt like the movie just got kind of dumber as it went on, until by the end, we've got really stereotyped villains who, you know, just weren't that interesting. I mean,
I think if he could have thrown a bowler hat at the end, it would have been really good.
Didn't you think Edward Norton was kind of wasted, though, in this? I mean, he had a really...
Well, only because he's so good. There are a couple of people like... I mean, I would have loved to have seen him had more. Obviously, Scott Glenn's a great actor as well. But, you know, there's a lot of people, Joan Allen, that are all superb actors. I just felt like couldn't we given them a bit more screen time if we had let go a bit more of the Bourne stuff? I mean, I would have even thought maybe it would have been better if the whole idea that there was Blackbriar and Treadstone was only linked at the very end, and you sort of realized where this fitted into a bigger jigsaw puzzle, and you had a kind of a reveal at the end, which would make it less dumb in the third act. I didn't hate the film, by the way. I actually kind of enjoyed it. I was along for the ride. But I found it in the first films, it was kind of complicated as to who was actually whose boss in Blackbriar and Treadstone. And I mean, obviously, I knew that where Joan Allen fitted, because her character was fairly well cast. But for a lot of the rest of them, I was always a bit confused as to who was pulling whose strings.
But I think that's actually one of the strengths of the movie, though, in that I think it functions in a kind of, there's this sort of Machiavellian thing that's going on in the sort of, you know, annals of these sort of secret organizations within the government, you know, and you're never really sure who's in political favor, you know, and has the power to make this, that, and the other happen. I kind of, or who's sort of crossing this, you know, sort of thin gray line of, you know, that you maybe should or shouldn't cross in a given scenario. And I kind of enjoy that sort of puzzle in the film where you're sort of trying to piece together, because I never found it so confusing that you can't follow the overarching story.
But
I
in
guess.
The earlier
But
films.
Would you go back and rewatch it to try to gather more of the plot? I'm not sure it would reward that.
No, I don't think that's really necessary.
See, in the first films,
I don't think you'd need to.
In the first films, it was exactly like you described. Like, exactly what you described is how I felt the first films. Like, I couldn't quite piece it together, but it felt like that was the problem that Jason had, right? Because Jason didn't understand it because he, you know, et cetera, et cetera. In this film, it was more like, oh, struth, I should have taken notes or done a bit of prep work before seeing this film because, hang on, oh, which one was which? I can't remember. It's a different sensation, the sensation that they're referring to stuff in previous films and I just am too dumb to remember it versus I'm in a film and I can't quite work out who's doing, who's pulling the strings, but that's part of the film. I just feel there's a subtle difference there, but maybe it's just me. Mm. Anyway, hey, I do think that, yeah, I don't want to be too down on it because I did enjoy it. It was fun. Mm-hmm. And
I just have to say I would rewatch it for the look, feel, and sound of it. I really, you know, it's a nice ride.
Yeah. So one of the things that the it's a bit of a trend, actually, that's been happening, but certainly we're seeing it with this film, is that the studio that's putting out the film says, hey, I really don't want anyone to know how we made this film. I think in this case it was Universal, was it? Anyway, so we're going to basically refuse to acknowledge there any visual effects work done in it because we want everyone to think it was for real. So remarkably, there isn't much about the visual effects. Obviously, there was quite a lot of visual effects. So we need to discuss the visual effects, but it's not from lack of research. It's literally from a deliberate studio perspective that it's you're not seeing much out there in terms of what was done. So we're going to try and rectify that by just discussing it anyway because we think the artists involved deserve the attention of what is, I think, some really good visual effects work. So I'm going to start with you, Mark, because you have a really good eye. How much did you spot the digital character in this?
The digital character?
Yes. I can't be more specific without giving it away.
I thought I spotted more than one.
Oh, okay.
But I thought the digital character work was really good. And if there were a shot from this film that I would want to claim as my own on a reel, it might be the final wipeout of our villain dude, whatever his name is.
Okay,
that is a really cool shot, and I was horrified watching that. Like, it just, that whole sequence was so good, and a lot of that is just killer second unit work by Dan Bradley. And, you know, I think, to your point, Mike, a lot of the VFX work on this movie was removing rather than adding.
Well, now I'm still fishing for whether you picked one plot point that was very digital character based. That was a good reference you gave. I agree, that was a cracker of a shot. That wasn't the one I was fishing for. Let me just swing to Matt and see if you know what I'm referring to.
Well, I don't know if I know what you're referring to, although the one shot that really stuck out in my mind is one that felt like a digital. Certainly there was some rig removal if it wasn't a digital character. It's the same character, but where he's sort of in the background and you first see him running and jumping onto this sort of large blue like scaffolding structure far in the background. And he does this like really insane leap, you know, across this very wide chasm between a structure and the scaffold.
Well, I'm going to use...
And that was the... Sorry?
I'm going to use host prerogative, and I'm going to... that is great. I'm going to discuss all that, I promise you. But I actually was going to the start of the film because... I think wolf work was so good. It just totally didn't... I mean, I was concerned about what was going on with the wolf. I was piecing together what he was doing with the transmitter and whether he was... whether, you know, it was what was going on because he was, like, sitting there on the ground. And I was engaged. I was interested. And then, of course, at some point, I realized that I'd been looking at a digital wolf. And I was like, oh, that is so good. So that's what I was referring to. So we'll get to that stuff at the end. But let's just discuss the opening sequences where he's in the test training facility and ends up having the house blown up and then doing the trick with the wolf. In terms of character work or digital character, I thought that wolf was so well executed. It was, I just couldn't see that it could be faulted.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't. I honestly did not know that it was a digital wolf.
My research turned up that it wasn't pure digital, that there was an actual wolf and that there was an animatronic wolf as well.
Yeah, there were wolves in the background. As I understand it, though, and I could be wrong, but as I understand it, because the main wolf sort of like gnarly straight at camera close-up stuff with Jeremy was a digital wolf. There was reason to have, you know, wolves obviously in background because there was more than one, and wolves that were shot and stuff, and also one that he was holding when he was trying to stick the thing down its mouth.
So you're saying the one where he's sitting, he's removed the transmitter from his leg, he's, you know, cleaned it off, he's now planning on putting it in the wolf, but the scene where he's sort of sitting against the tree and the wolf is staring straight at him, like baring its teeth, you're saying that was digital?
As I understand it, Mark, maybe you've got better info for me, so I understand it, yes, that it was, wow. There was an intercut between three things, a real wolf, but that wasn't about to eat anyone, a sort of a thing that he could grab, and there was a lot of like close-up shots, kind of wrestling. You couldn't kind of see what was going on.
Right.
That would be really hard to do those digital, and there was really no reason because you had no facial kind of performance required from the wolf. It was just, you know, like tussling and motion blur. I understand that was like the sort of, you know, maquette or animatronic or whatever you want to call it one they had. But Mark, do you know differently to that?
No, not really. And I was puzzling over, you know, I was thinking back to how Golden Compass won the Oscar how many years ago, 2010, I think, for all that interaction between digital characters and humans. And none of it was as aggressive as what was going on in that sequence from my recollection. So I was curious, you know, how exactly some of it was done. Like, it seemed possible to me that there was partial animatronic. The face was really well articulated and very expressive. I mean, the bared fangs, I could have done with maybe 10% more slobber. It just seemed maybe slightly clean. But honestly, yeah. I mean, that wolf had perfect teeth.
It was cold. I mean, come on.
And he brushes. He brushes and flosses.
Yeah, wolf performance anxiety. Okay, so now if you're listening to this and you're actually involved in that sequence, I am sorry that we're not allowed to officially talk to you to find out what your work did. But take it as a love letter from the VFX show to the Wolf team, that we three artists and professionals had a really hard time picking what you guys did digitally, what you did animatronically, and what you did normally. And so if we got it completely wrong, that is probably the biggest compliment we can pay you. But it was certainly a very, very well-executed scene. Now, there were some other things in that opening area, the quite spectacular shots from the aerials, but the main one, of course, being the drone attack and the explosion, which seemed to me to be well done. It was it played well. It was obviously, it seemed to be like a small amount of compositing to, you know, pull off a bunch of stuff, maybe some extra stuff added, and if you're not going to put your lead actor that close to a natural explosion. But generally speaking, I have no complaints of that that opening sequence. And the drone seemed believably sort of in the weather environment for what was clearly, I mean, would had to have been, I presume, a CG drone. And certainly I didn't feel like the drone control station with all of their monitors had an unrealistic amount of tech. What about you guys?
Yeah, no, I was just going to say about the drone sequence in particular. I have a strange fascination with all things drone oriented, and that I really enjoyed that part of the film. And I thought that you know, most of those shots were really successful. There was one shot in particular, I think, of the drone where we're sort of trailing behind the drone. I'm not sure if it was the drone that did the initial sort of, you know, drop off pickup on the skis, or if it was a later one when it's sort of coming back to do its dirty business. But there was one shot in particular where we're sort of, the camera's tracking behind the drone, and there's a, you know, pretty heavy thick snowfall, and there was a lot of really nice particle work of the snow sort of moving around and over the airflow of the wings and stuff like that. There was some good turbulating snowfall behind the tail of the drone. But I agree, Mike. I thought that the drone control center, whether that's total Hollywood you know, set design, or if there's some, you know, actual reality to that setup, it was great. And I would love to see a movie about that world, you know, of those pilots and that kind of stuff. It was just really fascinating, and I thought it looked really great.
Clearly in a big-budget movie, you can have a master control room with 50 monitors and throw that up on the big screen type stuff. And they did have that in other scenes. But the drone scene seemed to be particularly well executed for its art direction that wasn't over the top. Like, I can imagine if you're piloting drones, you don't need a room with 50 people sitting around with huge monitors looking like NASA Central Control. You're probably going to have a smaller space with a couple of operators and a supervisor, and you're not going to need like a massive complex per drone setup. And so what could have been ridiculous James Bond over-the-top kind of drone control station just felt like those sort of little details, just knowing when to pull back, gives it a realism that, again, I don't know if it's real, felt real.
But they kept it, the pilots, they kept on really pretty tight close-ups on their faces, and maybe one or two shots that were sort of more medium shots from behind, I think, the two pilots that were sitting at the station, and it looked like one guy behind them. And I thought that was really well done. And that's another thing that I think about this franchise in particular, and this movie, I thought, delivered in the same way, is that the way that the visual effects are incorporated into the film, one of the reasons why I think they're as successful as they are, and I think they're very successful, is because of the way in which the film is edited, with that sort of the action kind of cutting and stuff. And I think they're able to cut around and tell a story in a very efficient manner, and also work in conjunction, obviously, with the effects team to get, these really kind of key story points or action beats played out in a way that feels believable, that feels, photorealistic. It feels like it's actually happening in some fashion. And you're still able to sort of, even with sometimes shots that are probably, a second long or shorter in some instances, you're still able to piece together what specifically is happening in the action. And I think it's really successful in that way as well.
And Mark, wouldn't you add to that the camera work? Because I think the camera work, especially from the third film, there was some just spectacularly good camera work. And the franchise has a real hallmark of defining a good action sequence that is both very visceral and quite wobble cam, but not so wobble cam that you've got no idea which way is up. Like the house attack sequence on the scientist, where the agents come in and try and work out what she knows, and then all hell breaks loose. That was, I could understand where people were in relation to each other as much as I think the director wanted me to. There were obviously a couple of times when the director didn't want me to know where somebody was so that they could get a gag in of shooting through a door or whatever. But that camera work seems to work really well in terms of partnership with editorial.
Yeah, a couple things about that. One, rarely, if ever, did it call attention to itself. The camera moves felt dynamic and real and not, weird and fake and over the top. The other point in the favor of this film, I think, and I remember the VFX show from the last Bourne film way back when, and being hard on how much they were kind of covering their tracks by having so much shaky cam in that movie that there were a lot of shots that were practically hard to discern, and there were a lot more effects shots in that movie, but there was a hell of a lot more motion blur. Not that this one was static, it's quite a kinetic film, so they struck a real balance in this one, retaining that signature handheld dynamic style. But, I felt like there was a lot more discretion about what you could see and how well you could see it and what needed to be in the film or not.
Yeah, I felt you're right. I remember back that I went and saw one of the Bourne films, I think it was the third one, with somebody who actually got motion sickness, like car sickness, from watching it. and that's not good. That being said, I do think that that ability to get it moving, to get it, sort of very visceral, really adds a lot to what's going on. I think that's what you were referring to when you were talking about the Bond films, right? It gave it that energy to kind of move back. Now, I want to move on, if I can, to the super enhanced drug-induced extra powers, because I think this is interesting at a number of levels. It's interesting because it's quite a departure for the franchise to have someone with, I'm not going to say Superman-y powers or superhero powers, but certainly like, chemically enhanced radiation vat of, goo enhanced, I can do things that you can't stuff. Up until this point, especially in the Bourne films, when he's trying to get out of the American embassy, for example, you know, rips a sign off the wall because he doesn't know where he is in the embassy, and he uses that to look at it to try and work out how to have an escape. When he was in Russia, he has to grab a map from a convenience store because he doesn't know where he is, and so there was a lot of authentic kind of, you know, well, you wouldn't know where you are, would you? You'd have to have a map or something to work out how to escape. Where in this one, they sort of departed from that realism bent by having the blue and the green pills. And this leads to this ability to climb walls in a single bound. Now, I'd like both of you, starting with you, Matt, do you think that that worked visually on screen, given this departure, but in a kind of a franchise that's prided itself on realism?
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting point, because I actually went and I watched Todd Skolton put together a dossier on the film, and it's pretty thin, you know, not anything to do with Todd, but just like you said, because they've been so tight-lipped about you know, the visual effects work in the film. But there was one thing in the dossier that maybe will be in the show notes for the show that had a sort of a B-roll behind the scenes of a lot of the work that was done, both for the climactic motorcycle chase as well as the rooftop chase. And what's interesting is when you watch that B-roll footage, which I did before I saw the movie, I was watching that and I was like, oh boy, that looks pretty rough, you know, because you're seeing basically the actor, in this case, there are shots of Jeremy Renner, and he's wearing a harness and on a rig that where he's suspended, whether it's from a crane or some sort of a, you know, a trellis or a buttress or something above him. And they're pulling him essentially up the side of the wall, you know, in a couple of those key sequences where he's sort of climbing up this rebar and stuff. And he, you know, if you watch his arms, you know, he really is using his arms to pull himself up. But if you watch in the B-roll footage, his feet are, you know, have that real, they're barely touching the wall, right? So it's like the main muscles in his body, his legs, aren't really being utilized. And when I saw that footage, I thought, oh boy, that's, you know, I hope they, it doesn't look like that in the movie. And what was, I thought, actually pretty good in the movie is they did cut around all of that footage, you know, obviously, I mean, in keeping in pace with both the sort of kinetic and frenetic pace of that sequence, they cut really quickly and have these really quick, short action cuts. And I think there's only one shot where I saw his hit the lower part of his body making kind of, you know, haphazard contact. But it was at a moment when his arms were really lifting the bulk of his body up onto the top of this kind of rebar structure that he kind of runs out across, almost like a Super Mario Brothers kind of scene or something. But so I thought it worked pretty well. I think the only thing that I thought was problematic is in that big rooftop chase in particular, there really is no sense of where you are or where you're going. And the fact that he somehow winds up in this very narrow sort of chasm between these two buildings, right where the female protagonist, where the Rachel Weisz character, has sort of been cornered by these two police officers, seemed a little bit, you know, stretching the believability factor. But then, you know, maybe he heard the police whistle or something, which, you know, could be the conceit. But other than that,
well, they actually had established that he had superhuman hearing at the drone level. Remember at the beginning of the drone?
Yeah. But, yeah, I guess things didn't really... I mean, because I also always kind of felt like Jason Bourne, although he wasn't chemically altered, he certainly had... he was one of the most efficient, you know, on-screen fighters I think we'd seen to date at that time, like the way he sort of dispatched with his foes or his adversaries in a given moment. I mean, he was so quick, and the way they cut that around was so fast. It was like he was kind of this super warrior in a way, you know? And so the chemical enhancement, I don't know, it did not take away from the overall story for me. I was willing to go there with the narrative.
Mark?
Yeah, it would have been more of a problem if Matt Damon had shown up and suddenly had these powers. And, you know, thinking back, this movie is kind of odd because it really only has three main action sequences. And I would say the first two aren't big demonstrations of his superpowers. You could disagree with me on that, but I, you know, in the first sequence in Alaska, I see him as just being this Bourne-style, really great survivalist. In that last sprawling sequence in I want to say Manila, but it's Thailand, where I think, you know, it becomes part and parcel of what he's doing. And at that point, it's such a part of the story that he uses chemical enhancements that, you know, you've kind of been eased into it.
Okay, well, here's my take on it. This work was done by Level 256 in LA, and I think they did about 126 shots on the film, which included most of, I understand it, the wire and camera rig removal. So the stuff that we're talking about, this idea of running around the top of the Philippines or wherever it is, and atop of any other building, and having, you know, the ability to jump up high and stuff. And they also did monitor comps in that drone sequence that we're talking about. I'm sure they did other stuff like, well, I know they did. They did blood and other stuff on the bike sequences for continuity. But I think their work is great. Like, I think, just to get this out of the way, I think 256's level work is really, really good in terms of, I didn't sort of see anything that would say, oh, wow, that was bad rig removal. They did really good rig removal. And as a consequence, I'm not faulting that. I just think that there are a couple of sequences where he's scaling buildings that were just so ridiculously bad that I'm surprised you guys aren't more offended by them. My two offending cases are the first, when he appears at the house, her house, for that shootout gun battle. He scales the side of the building, and it just seemed like I was watching episodic television. It was...
He really kind of bounced up that wall.
He just bounced up that wall, and Super Mario Brothers is a good reference. And I'm just like, really? like somewhere somebody's shredding their credibility of the first three films in a way that I just didn't think they needed to, you know? Like, everything inside the house was much more played, but this scaling the house with sort of super ease in a single bound, I was like, nah, I don't want that. I don't want Bourne to go there, because... I liked it. I think that's what the Bond franchise lost, when they started getting Bond doing things that were clearly digitally enhanced, right, and lost that sense of realism. And the rest of the film didn't seem to have that. It's just those scalings were just not working for me. And I don't even know why you had to. There was no plot point that required him to get up the side of that building that fast. You know, if he had a couple more, like, he'd trouble getting up the side, I wouldn't have, like, thought it would have broken the plot. I wouldn't have thought it would have broken the pacing. I just thought, wow, that's completely unnecessary. And also, I don't believe that anyone thinks that you can take drugs and break the laws of physics. I think you can take drugs and go through a pain barrier. I know, I think you could use drugs and break your own wrist trying to get out of handcuffs, because, you know, your sort of pain receptors are gone. But I don't think they imagine that your muscles are suddenly capable of just vastly more physics than they were previously aware of. And we're way out of Batman League here, right? We're in like a gritty kind of realism world. And then the second one was that one you were referring to with the steel reinforcing out of the side of the building. Same deal. It was just like, really? Because on the top of the buildings, when they're running and they're doing unbelievably good jumps and stuff, like, that's all in the zone of, okay, fair enough, he's got really good balance, he's really, you know, good athlete, whatever.
But what about the part where he jumps off the final rebar onto the sort of rooftop below and he sort of rolls?
But even I can sort of, I don't know, that didn't bother me as much, I guess. I mean, it was sort of, again, we accept that he's meant to be better than normal. It's just the jumping up the buildings just always looked super fake. And it's not like we haven't just watched the Olympics where the best athletes in the world, you know, are doing things.
Well, I don't know. Some of them seem to defy physics, I thought, some of those gymnasts. But
never without momentum, never without inertia.
No, I know. So, I'm being sarcastic. I guess that's what I was sort of referring to in watching that B-roll footage. I feel like, you know, it's just totally egregious because it's not meant to be seen in that context. And I thought they did, you know, a fairly decent job of cutting around it. Now, maybe if I had watched it in another order, maybe I'd have a different feeling about it. But it didn't bother me as much as I think it sounds like it maybe sort of took you out of it.
Oh, I just felt like Bourne was so good in the first three films in reintroducing a level of realism. Like, your hero really suffered injuries that seemed to carry with him for more than 10 seconds. You know, I mean, okay, in Spider-Man, you can suddenly one second not be able to swing because you've got a hole in your leg, and the next second you just, you know, put a patch on it and you can run and jump and you don't have to worry about it ever again. I get that, right? It's a comic book. But in this, it was in the first three films, if Bourne really like broke a leg, he broke a leg and he kept it broken, kind of thing. And I certainly didn't feel in this that this was just like, okay, well, that level of commitment. And I think some of that actually goes to the actor. I think Matt Damon actually himself was quite adamant in some of that, you know, finding the map type stuff. He was really concerned that you just wouldn't be able to do this if you didn't know where you were going, kind of thing. And I just respected that enormously. Now, if you took those couple of shots out, the rest of it, the chemical enhanced thing, I think it's a reasonable plot line. It's a reasonable thing. I liked that there was actually some vague sense that there was an explanation of how this worked with the viraling it in. I mean, whether it's believable or not is up to you, but it's sort of like they gave the audience the credibility that it wasn't just miraculously happening, that there had been a breakthrough, that there had been something that had happened, and that there was a reason why it would be the way that it was. So I'm not faulting the rig removal, which I think was probably really hard, and I think rig removal is one of the least praised areas. But the main shop on this was, as I understand it, Dean Egg, and I believe Rhythm and Hughes were, I'm speculating now, I think Rhythm and Hughes were the Wolf, and the guys at Level 56 were doing the rig removal. But I just think now you cannot solve that shot. If you're the guy that's got him going up that side of the building at her house in the woods, and you ask to remove the rig, you remove the rig, but the waist is doing the lifting and the legs are not doing the pushing. The arms are certainly pulling up, but the wires are lifting from the waist, from the hip, and that movement is like a vertical lift with the wire going above you, where what you want is a push up from the legs, which normally would require an angled kind of body movement off the wall. But if you were to any way push with your legs while you're on a wire rig, you push away from the wall, you just swing out.
So right, and why not? I mean, I think you make a good point. I mean, why not in that instance, like to your point, why not just have him, you know, be wearing the harness and the rig so that, you know, maybe it's just very ever so slightly like pulling him up as he's actually climbing, but just have him really climb the building. And it's there as a harness, as a safety. Maybe it gives him some additional confidence and mobility or something. And you still do the rig removal. But yeah, why not just have him actually climb? And maybe have a little bit more slack in that line, and you'd wind up with something that was much more believable. And you could cut around it and still kind of give it sort of the heightened speed and maybe some of the, you know, heightened skill that you'd want this guy to have. You know, if he really is this sort of, you know, master super killing machine or whatever, you know, you want him to be able to sort of have that ability. But yeah, I think you could have definitely made it look better.
Mark?
Can I mention an over-the-top shot that I thought was awesome?
Yep.
The dirt bike down the stairs.
Yeah, that was fun.
That was so cool.
You know, where he sort of does like a skateboarding, like a rail slide.
Yeah. Yeah, he ollied down the banister of the staircase.
And I have
totally
to say,
ridiculous.
having been skiing recently and watching people rail down the snow, it introduced to me a level of, yeah, I could actually believe that someone could try that. And
Did they weigh 1,200 pounds?
Though? Well, but I see railing down the snow and I just think, man, I can't do that. And I'm a good skier, but I think, I can't do that. And if you told me that you would do that on skis 10, 15 years ago, I would have said, no, you're not going to do that. That's a snowboarding thing. And so,
well, a wooden banister is not going to support a motorbike.
Wasn't it a stone?
It's a great shot. It was like a John Woo movie shot or something.
Yeah. I thought it was a stone staircase kind of thing. I mean, you have the exterior one with the crowd, right?
Maybe it was stone. Maybe you're right.
Anyway, it was a good shot. And it was fun, so you give it some, you know what I mean? Like it's a plot point. Like, you need that. It was a fun escape solution. I don't think going up the side of the building was in any way any of those things. It was neither fun, nor plot important, nor a cheer moment. Like, I think the audience just kind of cheers for him when he does that, right? Like, it's...
Yeah, actually, yeah. It became a problem on the very end. The end of the last chase sequence kind of dropped with a thud, and it's not a big VFX shot when they just kind of go sliding into a big pile, but it was a moment where I got taken out of the film because I thought, okay, why does nobody's leg ever break in one of these things? Because I watched that wipeout, and I'm thinking, I mean, this girl is not superhuman. She just broke some stuff. Like, there's just no doubt about it.
She'd have shredded her back. I think she skidded on her back at the end of that.
Basically, they brushed themselves off and they were okay, you know?
So now let's go back to your death scene of our evil assassin, sans bowler hat. The his death, I mean, it's a bit of a thing, right, that the superhero-y guy is actually defeated by the girl, not by the equal superhero-y guy, and that she actually manages to sort of do something. And I thought that was well handled, and that she tried it twice. She didn't just get him on the first attempt. Mm-hmm. That being said,
that was cool.
Yeah, that was cool. It was cool. It was fun. And I totally reacted in the theater when he goes A over T. That was...
Oh, yeah. So that was just a spectacular wipeout.
Talk to us about that, because I cut you off before you went to talk about it. So what do you think was going on?
I mean, clearly that was digital double work. I mean, it did remind me a little bit of a horror story I remember hearing from George Lucas's own mouth about there's a dude who does an end over on a bike in THX 1138, and the guy actually on the day. But this was well beyond that. I mean, it's pretty amazing to see a shot that you know has to be digital, even as you're watching it, and it's still just like goosebumps on the back of your neck at how harrowing.
I think what made it work too, though, was that, you know, they really went for, I think, a kind of almost like a level of realism and believability with the crash, where it was like it felt like. You know, like he went into almost like a ragdoll kind of, and it was quick, real fast, but it looked like the kind of thing that you'd see on some, you know, not that I really have spent much time watching these things, but like some, you know, Faces of Death kind of video, where it was like really, just, you knew there was no recovery, and to see it felt so wrong, but it looked so real. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if I remember it incorrectly, but I remember that shot as being the actors on the lead bike on camera right, and that happening on sort of middle of screen with the pole on camera left. And so I think if I remember that shot correctly, it was greatly helped by having foreground actors and foreground action. And I think that was out of focus slightly because we had more of the focus on them, which again added to the realism because you weren't just cutting to low wide shot so you could appreciate it. It was sort
and
of happening.
Wasn't he
in the
inverted
shot
too? Like he was upside down, I think.
Yeah.
Wasn't
yeah.
He?
Yeah.
Like he'd gone over the handlebars and was like upside down, like heading into this thing.
Well, that's what made me think of the THX shot, I think.
Yeah. But, yeah, which is a great shot, by the way, if anybody wants to go back and look at that. It's amazing. I think it's
fine.
And yet, I think
isn't
I was
that
almost
in the tunnel in Berkeley, right? That's where they shot some of that
one
stuff.
One of the tunnels around the Bay Area. Yeah.
It's funny because I'm sure I was actually looking away from the screen as that was happening because it was one of those, ooh, that's going to hurt kind of moments.
It's probably, I mean, honestly, classic visual effects, it's probably a 40-frame shot, but it was really spectacular.
That was 40
frames.
I'd say
if even 40 frames. I mean, it felt really short. 40 frames with handles.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. 25 frames. And the other thing about it is that you needed something big to kill that guy because the thing that you don't want, I certainly didn't want, is the, oh, hang on, he's not dead. He's going to get up, stumble over, and at the last second, somebody's going to throw a knife or shoot over somebody else's shoulder and get rid of him. And when he went over, I was like, okay, that's it. You're out. Thanks. Game over. That was effectively it. You need a good full stop to kill your baddie. Even though our baddie had only been introduced what seemed like 10 minutes earlier. But yeah.
Yeah, but he was a much cooler baddie than any of those dudes in the control room or anywhere else lurking around on the plot line.
Yeah, I'd have loved, I mean, I don't know, maybe this is just huge 2020 hindsight. I'd have loved his girlfriend to have been the Chinese girl that got the yellow pill earlier. I'd have loved to have some connection with that guy.
So it's a revenge?
Well, yeah, revenge, and this guy is just really is willing to still work for the company that killed his girlfriend because he really doesn't have remorse and doesn't empathize. And
yeah, I guess that's not really revenge. It's a vengeance plot or something.
Yeah, but anyway, just to give him a bit more dimension.
Sort of a little rat hole. One thing I just wanted to toss out there, which I thought was something that I actually found it really disturbing. Maybe just in the context of sort of, you know, recent news events, but I thought the two sequences that really kind of gave me the creeps were the ones both in the laboratory where the her sort of cohort scientist kind of goes on this very methodical and slow kind of, you know, sort of office style shooting rampage, and then that sequence is sort of in a slightly different way is kind of repeated again in her house later. And I found that equally disturbing in that they made this sort of effort to sort of gain her trust. And she's really kind of an in a lot of ways kind of a, you know, an innocent in the story, and then they try to make, they're sort of trying to make it look as if she's going to shoot herself. And I mean, just the sort of the psychological horror of, I think, both of those two sequences was were really
the latter one of those didn't bother me. I thought that was legitimate, kind of, you know, the spies, they're in a house, they're everywhere, he comes in, it's a shootout, a couple of clever tricks with fire extinguishers. I thought that was all great, totally good. But I totally agree with you. I almost was thinking to myself, they've crossed a line with the lab sequence because they're just...
Yeah, it just was almost too real.
Yeah.
I mean, the idea of him going in and taking those door handles off, you know, so that they couldn't get in, and, like, you know, making it so that... all these people are trapped, and then it was also so unclear to me, like, why was he willing to do this?
But
like,
I think what that's what was unsettling about it.
I mean, they made
it.
Some allusion to, like, you know, that he had been given some kind of a drug or something, but that even seemed kind of hard to believe. It was hard to see.
Brainwashing is such a central conceit to the whole series that you're supposed to accept.
Yeah, that's true.
But don't you think that's one of the reasons why it was
sorry, not to go off the rails there, but those are two sequences that, as we start talking about some of these things, that I thought were, you know, ones that worthy of mention, at least in that they seem so, in a way, they seemed really out of context with the film. Although I guess in the previous Bourne, the first Bourne film, I guess there is that scene in the apartment in France with the guy who jumps out the window at the end.
But I just felt like what made that so horrific was he was doing senseless killing, and senseless killing has been in the news far too much in the last, you know, few months, if not few years, that it was the senseless, and the fact that you couldn't understand his motivation, as I could not understand the motivation of a guy walking into a cinema on Dark Knight Rises, that's what bugged me. Like, it was, this guy is doing horrible things, and I didn't doubt him in the film, but I just knew that I had no reason why he would do those things. I mean, even, okay, I'm going to go stick my neck out here and I'm going back to Boomtown Rats, but it was like, you know, what reason do you need to die? It was just that horrible kind of someone goes postal and they just seem to do it, and you've got never in the slightest heck of a chance of knowing why they were doing what they were doing. It was just violent. And, I found that deeply disturbing. I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah.
So any shots I've scrubbed those two shots I didn't really like at all. I found them really annoying. But other than that, Matt, was there anything that stood out for you? I mean,
I think of shots I didn't like.
Yeah. Or did for them. Yeah.
I could think of some ones I really did like, but of, which I've mentioned a couple of already, but the one shot, or I guess it was sort of a few shots in sequence that I really didn't like, and it was maybe for me the physics of the shot were kind of cryptic, and I didn't quite understand what's going on. It was when, during the bike chase, when I think she's taken off her helmet at one point, she tries to swing her helmet at the guy, and then she falls to the side and is sort of in peril, but there's this, you know, kind of disco, downtown disco bus kind of thing next to her. And she's sort of like between the bus and the motorcycle, but they're still going forward. But yet it felt like they were also kind of going sideways. And I wasn't really clear on exactly what was going on there. And those shots for me were just, I don't know if that, I guess, they're not digital shots, I don't think. I think they're primarily just, you know, practical stunt effects type shots. But those didn't work for me. It just felt like there was something odd about that beat of action.
And what about you, Mark?
This is super nitpicky, but I felt like I could pick which fire shots were practical and which were digital. And I thought they were all good. I just didn't find that they matched one another entirely. And that's just because that's the kind of thing I totally nerd out on. It would be interesting, actually, to give me a test and see if I was right.
Yeah. Well, this.
Do you mean the fire shots of her house burning?
Yeah. Yeah.
So this is seriously, if you're listening to this and you're part of the show and you wanted to tell us that we're right or wrong anonymously, perhaps because the studio doesn't want, you know, do you publicly, email me mikes@fxguide.com. I'd be more than happy to anonymously give a scorecard on the three of us on this film, because we really have we are looking at this with a remarkable lack of and not for want of, you know, trying. Can I just give one other shout out? I did think, as I have in previous films, that the sound design on this was really good. And it really makes a difference. And I've got to say, it's one of the reasons to go to a cinema. Everyone always talks about frame rates and big screens. But one of the reasons I think it's really great to go to a cinema still is you get just such good sound reproduction, and the surround sound systems are so good. And if you've got a good sound designer, as they had in the case of this film, they make use of that. It just doesn't happen in my house. If I'm watching it on TV, I'm sorry, I've even got a surround system. I very rarely get off the couch and plug it all in. I'm nearly always just hearing off two speakers. I don't know about you guys, but I for special events, if I get a Blu-ray, I will fire it up. But more often than not, I just don't. And yet, it's what makes the film sometimes really such a good experience at the cinema, which is having that terrific sound design and good sound reproduction. Do you agree, Mark?
Yeah, and it wasn't just that things blew up in a really spectacularly high decibel way. The integration of the soundtrack makes this movie feel really cool in a way that like reminds me of The Italian Job, or there have been certain films that just really do a nice, like, I wouldn't go buy the soundtrack and listen to it, but in the context of that movie, it just really gave it an awesome kind of overall feel. So with any good sound system, you could enjoy that. The cinema where I went and saw this had this XD screening. I don't know if that exists elsewhere, but it's being marketed as kind of half IMAX. And I don't know if I'm going to be a big proponent of that. It was basically, to be honest, the screen was maybe a little too big for the room. Right. And I don't think this film benefited from it.
I'm a big believer that unless a film's designed for IMAX, I'm not rushing to see it in IMAX, because I find the framing, which is so important, is so kind of skewed in an IMAX experience. Certainly in my case, the IMAX is so big that the hotspot moves lower on the screen. So whereas in the cinema, I'd be looking kind of more at the middle of the screen, I'm looking at the lower third, and I lose a lot of stuff at the top in an IMAX projection. And so I know it's a trend these days, like a film that wasn't shot for IMAX to... Now, I'm not talking about Dark Knight Rises, which we had this really in mind, but I think that if you do get an overly large screen, it isn't necessarily better. It's
especially for a film like this, too, where it's shot and edited in such a really frenetic way that I think it wouldn't play well on a larger screen, maybe in the same sense.
Yeah, it looked grainier. I actually watched it. I went into both theaters to compare. And so this is more of a caveat emptor, because it was nowhere near an IMAX experience anyway. And so I'm just saying to anybody, if you're at the cinema and you've got an opportunity to spend like $3 extra for XD, you might want to save the money for popcorn or something else.
So any other points in finishing up? Or I think we've covered the film pretty well. As I say, I didn't hate the film. I did have some issues with it. I thought it was a good film. I wasn't disappointed. I went and saw it. I didn't certainly feel ripped off.
I guess I would just say, to people, if you like the Bourne movies, if you've enjoyed the last few Bond movies, like, I think it's on par with those. Maybe it's not as good. It doesn't have the same kind of star power maybe as some of those other films. But I mean, I really enjoyed myself. It was a great fun ride, and I was, enjoyed watching the characters and sort of following along with the story. And, there's some fun visual effects in there to boot. So, I mean, I think it's one that's, worth at least a matinee price.
I think Matt Damon's shoes are incredibly big shoes to fill, and Jeremy Rayner does an exceptionally good job at it. So I'm going to give him an enormous amount of credit for why I thought this film was as good as it was, because I could have hated any other actor trying to lead a film like this, because I so like watching Matt Damon on screen. So, yeah. What about you, Mark?
Basically, enjoyable movie, great in the cinema, will be fine to watch at home too. No need to pay too much attention to the plot. Don't get as frustrated as I did with the first act, how many references to previous Bourne films, unless you like that. If you like the mind candy and like to figure out all the connections, then go see at least the previous film and maybe the whole series, and then enjoy it.
I will say this, before I went and saw this film, I know that I was looking forward to the next Bond film, probably five times more than I was looking forward to this film. I can't judge them yet because I haven't seen the new Bond film, but man, that looks great. And if the Bourne legacy caused the Bond films to become great again, then I'll give them loyalty just for that alone.
Hey, I'm just curious, did you guys, since this is a Universal picture, I think this is also a Universal film. I saw a trailer before this for a movie called Branded. Did you guys see that trailer?
Not in my country.
No, I don't think I did.
All right, well, never mind then. But all I'll say is it looked like it had tons of effects in it, and man, it looked weird.
There are some good films coming up. There's a Tarantino coming up that looks really interesting from a visual effects point of view. There's a lot of good stuff coming up later in the year, and especially around Christmas time. Well, that's it for this week. Thanks so much for being with us on the show. Matt, where are you on Twitter?
I'm on Twitter at Matt Wallen.
And of course, do you want to give a plug for where you're teaching?
Oh, yeah. I'm at Virginia Commonwealth University in the School of the Arts, and classes start tomorrow morning at 9. So if you're planning on being there, I'm taking roll at 9 o'clock. You better be on time.
Okay, and Mark?
Oh, shoot. I'm not going to make it. Flow Seeker on Twitter. And my plug would be for the Cinefex app, which I can finally talk about on this show.
Oh, which is awesome, by the way.
Alluding. Thank you. Yeah. Well, a lot of credit goes to Cinefex themselves because they have great relationships with studios, and they've managed to find a bunch of extras that are on there. So there's some really nice behind-the-scenes footage. I think it gives a lot of new life to Cinefex. And then if you look at the app, God, you'll get a hint of where we're going with it as well.
Yeah, the extras that are in I think the four issues that are currently available, the video extras that you have in there they are spectacular. I think it goes beyond the scope of the magazine. I mean, it really puts into context so much of the visual effects and the films that are covered in what has always been really the premier magazine for the industry. I mean, I just think it's amazing, and I cannot wait until I can go back and buy some back issues that I've never had. And it'd be great if I don't know if they'll be able to do that, but if they were able to dig up some video extras even for some of those old issues as well.
Yeah, video extras for the old issues might be a little harder to come by given all the studio restrictions on releasing anything. But who knows?
So that is available as a free thing in the iTunes store, right, Mark?
Yeah, the app's free, and there's one free issue, which isn't the most recent issue. It's actually the earliest of the available new issues. So the new issues have a layout that Cinefex designed, and the back issues will be a different experience, which I look forward to sharing what's
but we if
have
I
in
if,
there.
If I wanted to look at the newest issue, I would get the app, just so people understand. I would download the app to my iPad, which would be free, and then there's an in-app purchase if I want to then, say, buy the next issue of Cinefex when it comes out, whenever that comes out next, right?
Yeah, and how much does that cost options. Me? You can certainly start by just grabbing the free issue 127 and check that out. And you can point purchase any of the available issues. And then you can actually subscribe on the iPad as well. Cinefex decided to make it a separate subscription from the print, and there have been questions of people saying, I've been a loyal subscriber for a long time, and, could I have a free subscription, please? That's not how they chose to do it. And, so it's if you are a subscriber, you may be faced with a choice of, do you want both? Do you want one or the other, et cetera? But,
So a Cinefex is four issues a year. Yeah. It's what, $5 an issue and $19 for the year, is that right, I think?
Correct. So you say you actually save quite a bit of money over the print subscription. I do know that Cinefex is very invested in keeping their print edition at the quality and circulation that it's been. So the print's not going anywhere. But yeah, it's for many people it will be easier to consume and cheaper to purchase.
Great. Well, look, obviously I'm Mike Seymour on Twitter. Please send your comments and stuff to us about the show, especially I know a lot of artists that work on the shows listen to the shows, and we are totally happy to be confidential in terms of if you wanted to point out that we, you wanted just to give us a correction or give us a heads up, or even just flag the fact that your work was so good that we didn't even realize it was visual effects work. But thanks so much for listening, guys. We really appreciate it. I'm certainly sticking with the green pills, and we'll catch you next time. See ya.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com. Copyright 2012, FX Guide, LLC.